Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is Kathy Conrad, Principal Deputy Associate Administrator, the Office of Citizen Services and Innovative Technologies within the U.S. General Services Administration. Also joining our conversation from IBM is Ken Beecher. So, Kathy, before we delve into specific initiatives, would you briefly outline your office's strategic vision and highlight some of the key priorities that frame the direction in which you're taking the office?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, we have a dual mission to deliver innovative services and solutions for the, to the public and to our government agency customers. So to deliver our mission, we have three key strategic goals. Innovation, which we define as expand and enhance public engagement with government using innovative, cost-effective solutions and practices that can be adapted and adopted government-wide. Second, customer intimacy, as I mentioned. And there we want to deliver best-in-class customer experience that is driven by results and that other agencies can use. And finally, operational excellence. Develop, implement, and accelerate adoption of new technology platforms and initiatives that can improve operational efficiency and effectiveness across government. We seek to foster federal leadership in implementing solutions that are faster, cheaper, and more sustainable.
You know, Kathy, you mentioned earlier that you have a very close and tight relationship with the Office of Management and Budget. And as you know, OMB is mandating a cloud-first policy. And your office is the government-wide lead on making this effort successful. To that end, would you elaborate on the Federal Cloud Computing Initiative? What are the benefits and challenges of pursuing a cloud-first approach?
Okay, I'll try to answer that.
All right, thanks.
So cloud-first has driven a major shift in IT planning and procurement. It's forcing agencies to consider whether there are better, more agile ways to use scarce IT resources to enable achievement of desired program and mission outcomes. It's important to remember cloud computing is not about the technology. It's about mission enablement. So what is it? Lots of different definitions, but I think the best way to think about it is as a utility, where you buy the services you need to meet real-time demands. Cloud solutions offer infrastructure as a service solutions like servers and storage that can be used to host websites and meet other requirements, software as a service for applications such as email, or platform as a service which can be used for testing and development, other requirements. In terms of benefits, there are really three key benefits. First, it's cheaper. Services are automatically delivered and consumed as they're used, which means you only pay for what you actually use. Agencies can shift from owning and maintaining costly physical assets to managing service delivery, reducing the need for ongoing capital expenditures. And cost savings are also achieved from aggregated demand. If you can aggregate demand across an entire enterprise, you benefit from economies of scale and save significant funds over the long term. Second, it's actually better in terms of performance. On-demand services enable flexible, rapid response to dynamic business needs. So you know that as your needs change, you can get the services that you actually need. And it's faster. You can provision services rapidly and automatically, dramatically decreasing time to deploy or implement solutions. So it's better, faster, and cheaper. Seems like a pretty good deal.
Absolutely. And as a follow-up, what has been accomplished in this area to date, and what implementation issues have you encountered, and what remains to be done?
So we launched FedRAMP's initial operating capability in June, and to date, we've accredited 15 third-party assessment organizations and received over 50 applications for FedRAMP assessment and authorizations. In the data center consolidation program, as of August, 318 data centers have been closed to date. And there are 932 plan closures by the end of 2015.
So, Kathy, you've mentioned FedRAMP, which is the Federal Risk Authorization Management Program, a couple of times in our discussion. Would you tell us what exactly that is, and how does it seek to accelerate the adoption of secure cloud solutions?
Okay, so FedRAMP initial operating capability was launched in June following 2 years of extensive collaboration with both government and industry to develop a do-once-use-many-times approach that saves cost, time, and staff needed to conduct cloud security assessments. FedRAMP has four primary components. It's established a baseline set of mandatory security controls that are based on NIST 853 standards for low and moderate impact systems. It establishes a consistent, rigorous, independent assessment process, including accreditation of third-party assessment organizations, which we call 3PAOs. We couldn't resist the idea to come up with a new acronym, which must be used under FedRAMP. And it introduces the use of provisional authorizations, which are granted by a joint authorization board composed of the CIOs from DOD, DHS, and GSA. Provisional authorizations can be leveraged by agencies across government in granting their own authorities to operate. And finally, FedRAMP shifts the government towards real-time assurance through the use of continuous monitoring. So the combined use of baseline security controls, consistent security assessments, and provisional authorizations gives agencies the high trust and confidence they need to leverage existing ATOs rather than conducting their own duplicative expensive assessments each time they implement a cloud solution.
So can I just clarify, if they use FedRAMP, they won't need to do their own ATO?
They still, under FISMA, agencies are still have the statutory responsibility of granting their own ATOs. But instead of starting from scratch, they can leverage the existing ATOs, which will be maintained in a secure repository. And then if they have requirements that are above and beyond the FedRAMP baseline, which, by the way, we hope will not often be the case, they can assess those requirements in addition to what is already included in the security packages that are the basis of the ATO they're reviewing from the repository.
So, Kathy, my next question is around open government initiatives, and it's two-pronged. And first, I want to understand, how does your office transform citizen engagement with government, and what prompted such efforts?
So there are really, you know, the president released the Open Data Directive back in 2009, and that really was the catalyst for the open government movement that we see today. And one of the things that we've seen is that while at the time that was really a pretty radical idea, it's become really baked into agency operations. People really now see that sunshine is the best medicine for data quality. I think the risk aversion that we saw in the early years of open data has really kind of evaporated. You still find it in certain areas, but there's a level of acceptance that open data is good for the government and even better for citizens. So where we are today, there are really three areas that define open government today. One is the transformation from focusing on the data itself to the impact of the data. Two, a shift toward really what's become a global open government movement. And three, the growth of the communities. And if you'd like, I can talk about each of those three areas a little bit. So in terms of impact, you know, initially open government really focused on transparency, accountability, and citizen engagement. Those principles, as I said, are widely accepted and kind of part of just our government culture. So the emphasis has now expanded, and the future of data.gov is to focus on enabling data discovery, use, and impact, making sure that through APIs and open data standards, citizens, developers, and others can easily access and harness the value of data to develop new products and services that improve the quality of people's lives. So it's really about impact. And as is outlined in the digital strategy that was released in May, over the next 9 months, data.gov will be expanded to include a web API catalog that will serve as an interactive directory of information made available to the public by agencies via web services so that customers can more readily use that information. And again, it's about that use that is so critical. So every agency is required to post their APIs on their /developer pages that they're establishing under the digital strategy, and those will automatically be aggregated in data.gov's catalog. So some big changes along the way, but all that will focus on impact. For the global movement, one of the things that I've done recently that was really just invigorating was that we held a conference with the World Bank this summer on international open government. It was attended by more than 400 leaders from more than 50 countries, all of whom are working toward expanding the open government data movement. It was really quite remarkable. Governments around the world really have recognized the value of open data and transparency to drive economic development and citizen engagement. And while there was some focus on transparency, there was a real emphasis on how open data can help these developing nations prosper. Lots of emphasis on what's the economic impact, not just transparency and accountability. Along those lines, as is called for in the U.S. National Action Plan, and in what we really consider a triumph of 21st century digital diplomacy and development, we've developed in less than a year an open source platform to enable governments around the world at any level to open their data to the public. So in March, the U.S. and the government in India proudly launched the Open Government Platform, OGPL, which is this new open source product that includes the code, tools, and processes that help government to manage and release their data and will enable developers, analysts, journalists, academics, and the public to put this data to work. The full package, which is in early release, is available for download, comments, and open source development at GitHub. We'll be supporting OGPL in several countries, beginning with Rwanda this fall.
I'd like to focus in on two particular initiatives, challenge.gov, and you mentioned already data.gov. Can you tell us a little bit about these initiatives and what are the benefits and where are they to date?
Okay, so as I mentioned with data.gov, we're driving towards an API catalog. We've also been establishing communities in key sectors to engage and collaborate around new ways to analyze, visualize, and use the data. As I said, data.gov really can't just be about the data. It has to be about its potential for use, deriving value from the data, not just analyzing it. So currently, data.gov hosts 15 communities, which we've built in collaboration with agencies across the government in areas such as health, education, law, energy, oceans, safety, ethics, sustainable supply chain. We've had these really cool data jams and data paloozas to spur entrepreneurship, create value, and create jobs while rigorously protecting personal proprietary national security information. The safety community had a data palooza that brought together people who use the data available on data.gov to save lives. And we saw some really amazing, really cool apps at that data palooza. You want me to tell you about a few of them? So Pulse Point was from the San Ramon Fire Protection District and is a life-saving mobile app that allows CPR-trained volunteers to be notified if somebody nearby is in need of emergency assistance. We saw some commute and crime maps from Trulia that allow home buyers to choose their new residence based on important factors such as commuting times and crime rates, which would otherwise never be available, or at least not easily so. And then we saw a really cool hurricane app from the American Red Cross that allows citizens to monitor storm conditions, prepare families for emergencies, find help, and let people know that they're safe even if there's no power. So that's where things are with data.gov. If data.gov makes data discoverable and accessible, challenge.gov offers a new tool and platform to engage the public in harnessing the value of the data, as is documented very, very well and very thoroughly in your recent excellent report on challenge.gov. So challenge.gov is a crowdsourcing platform for challenges and prizes for solutions to government problems. Many of them use open data sets. It's important to note that agencies are actually authorized to conduct these competitions and contests under the American Competes Act. There's still some skepticism about whether agencies can really do this. And in fact, they not only can do it, they are doing it. When we launched challenge.gov back in 2010, we had 35 challenges from 15 different agencies. As of this week, we have 211 challenges from 47 agencies, an average 7 new challenges a week. Some of the benefits of using challenges are that it's very cost-effective. You pay only for successful entries or solutions, so you're not paying for anything that you don't, in fact, really want and that doesn't meet your criteria. It allows for really, really broad engagement. Innovative and ideas and expertise is tapped from well beyond traditional sources. And it allows the government to partner with the private sector to fund or expand prizes, and has proven to be really just an amazing tool for achieving big breakthroughs where solvers invent products, write software, design systems, develop mobile apps, create videos, games, and more. It also creates a social network of people who care about an issue, who can follow and vote and share information about the challenges through email, Facebook, and Twitter. So that builds awareness and interest in critical agency policy national issues at much lower cost than a traditional communications campaign might do. So some of the examples that might be of interest, USDA had a really great challenge on apps for healthy kids that was sponsored by First Lady Michelle Obama. Winners included a game called Hungry Hiker that was in the Denver Science Museum that allowed kids to guess if they fueled their body with different fuels, how quickly they could hike to the top of a mountain. Quickly became apparent that candy alone wasn't going to make it. Another one that I personally love called Explode Your Food, because anybody who has kids knows that kids love to play with their food, and this allows you to put virtual food into a machine, and it blows it up, makes a really lovely, wonderful mess, and analyzes the nutritional content. Today, there are a couple of really great challenges that are going on today. In fact, the Department of Treasury is holding a ceremony to announce the lucky winners of their My Money App Up Challenge for mobile apps that can offer consumers faster, more convenient, and better access to financial products, services, and tools, and information to empower consumers to make better, positive financial choices. There are 8 finalists, one of whom will win the $10,000 grand prize. There's also a really neat contest going on sponsored by the White House Council on Women and Girls. It's called the Equal Futures Application Challenge to promote development of apps that inspire girls to serve as leaders in our democracy and promote civic education. So those are just a bunch of examples. There are many, many more on challenge.gov.
How is GSA working to provide information where, when, and how the public wants it? We will ask Kathy Conrad, Principal Deputy Associate Administrator of GSA's Office of Citizen Services and Innovative Technologies, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour.